direction now. I apologize to those of you who read the paper. It was a bit long. And as Andreas remarked to me earlier, it was a bit dense.
I meant it in a good way.
It was a very kind, very kind.
These words are dense, but in some persons we don't know.
He didn't mean to be unkind. I'm just saying so in a sort of apologetic way. I would like to keep my presentation fast so that we can have a longer discussion. For those who've read the paper, I have tried to take a slightly different approach here than in the paper to investigate the same kinds of issues. I'm still going to be talking about moral logics in pricing in Final Fantasy XI, and I'm going to be using players' normative terms throughout, because something that frustrates me when we talk about moral dimensions of the economy, which I think comes out of Clea's presentation as well, is that sometimes we are not as reflexive about when we are using normative phrases when we aren't. So I'm going to be upfront from the start. I'm talking in players' normative terms. I've been doing this work for a long time, and one of the things that has repeatedly struck me over and over again is people like Lane Deer, who's a television repairman in the American South. He hasn't even finished high school yet, and he's, you know, in his 40s. Yet he knows everything there is to know about economics, but no one would ever look at him and say, yeah, dude, you're an economist. But actually, I think he could hold his ground against Mr. Stiglitz and his colleagues. So we know these guys. I think we can recognize them by their facial hair. It's often said in economic sociology that very little has been written on price. Well, actually, what is Karl Marx's entire corpus of work but a reflection on exploitation and price? It's a bit crass characterization, but it is a key part. And Georg Simmel was really concerned with moral dimensions of price. Anyone who's read The Philosophy of Money and can call to mind the section on the unearned increment of wealth, or the section on unequal pricing, which Nigel Dodd has recently written about in his piece on Simmel and Utopia. And now, Durkheim didn't have too much to say except in economic normative terms about price in the division of labor, but Weber has a couple extended meditations in Economy and Society, fragmented though it is, on price as a negotiated process, as a series of institutional outcomes. So I think there's been more written on price, actually, if we go back to those dead white men we all know and love, than we might suspect. And of course, there's been talk today about valuation studies. We've been there, we've done that. And again, price is a secondary outcome of these kinds of studies. And there's been a tremendous amount of work, which has come out again today, in the STS, or Social Studies of Finance, around market formation, which is also price by another name in some cases. Beckert, everybody knows Jans Beckert, he wrote an article in 2011 about how nothing has been written about price, and then surprisingly had a number of references to talk about price from Nothing Has Been Written About Price. And Frederick Wary has written a wonderful piece about the social characterization of price. And if you read the paper, you'll note that I make this argument that the economy of Final Fantasy XI can be seen as this sort of struggle between the frivolous and the faithful. I'm not going to get into that in detail, but there's also Veltuis, who's written about price in the primary art market. So I think there's more about price in economic sociology than we generally think about, but it happens sort of not at the center. Well, let's move somewhere different. This is Final Fantasy XI. There you have it. This is a bunch of people standing at the auction house. In this virtual world, player-to-player transactions dominate. So that means players are setting prices for goods. They are setting prices for services, even. There's an example in the paper about the teleport services and how there are certain normative expectations of what other players of certain roles must do within certain service transactions. This is the auction house. There's a tremendous amount of discussion in the paper about the auction house. This doesn't really look like Sotheby's or Christie's or an estate auction. This is a bunch of people silently standing in front of a little counter. This arch here is the counter. And making their transactions. And this is the interface they see in the weapons section with all kinds of different ways of bludgeoning, tearing, and ripping things apart. And this is a sales record. This is a bit unusual in that you have one seller who is selling to all these other people at the same price. But I invite anyone who has a computer with an internet account to visit FinalFantasyAH.com, and you will see that this is not abnormal. Customary pricing is the rule in auction houses. You set the price, your demand price, according to what has been sold in the past, which is a pretty static way of thinking about an economy. It's an economy that doesn't grow. It's an economy that stays the same, which is a bit different than what we live in generally capitalist societies. Another way that players can transact goods is through a bazaar. I've talked in the paper about how there are three main ways of using bazaars. There's a fourth one which I haven't talked about. It's not quite relevant here. But here you see two players on chocobos, and one is looking at the bazaar of the other. And so that's a mobile bazaar. Here you have a number of characters who are all lined up on a run path through a particular city, and that's more of a marketplace. I don't have a picture of the opportunist bazaar, but you can imagine the middle of a jungle and someone just sitting there with no clothes on. That's pretty much it. It's a player who has left their character sitting out in the middle of nowhere, wearing no clothes, because clothes take inventory space. And you don't want to waste your inventory space on clothes when you can use them to sell things. Why wear clothes? It's interesting, though, in the marketplace that a number of these characters are wearing clothes. This fellow here, who you cannot see very well, is wearing a chef's apron and a chef's hat. So that tells anyone running by immediately what he is selling, because you would have to look at his character and input a couple of commands to actually see the goods otherwise. Different pricing logics prevail in different kinds of bazaars. If you do a search on the internet for Giant Donko, apparently you will come up with me, and a lot of really crude and jokes about men's penises. Because in Final Fantasy XI, a giant donko is a giant fish, but it's also a synonym through the auto-translate for being very well endowed. Apologies if I make the men in the room feel uncomfortable. But joke prices are a fantastic subversive use of the bazaar function. So there was a time in around 2005 where every male character had a donko in his bazaar for as big a price as he could possibly put on it. I'll leave you to interpret what that might mean. And then, so mobile prices are funny. They're lowest reasonable because of the things you can't sell. An opportunist bazaar is usually an aesthetic of the good figure. There's another paper we're going to hear today about prices in flea markets. And again, there's the idea that there's a good price, a round price. And I've written about that a bit more in a different context in a paper about the use of rubles in Russia. And then marketplace kinds of bazaars like this are generally priced against auction house prices. So the customary price minus about 10%. Because if it's more than 10% below, then you're undercutting. But there's another area of economic transactions, and that's non-player character merchants. These are prices that are extremely low, usually. But I've talked in the paper about how a particular kind of non-player merchant has an impact on pricing strategies for particular kinds of crafting goods. This is because some characters, non-player character merchants, have goods that are inaccessible, and it's very difficult to know where to find them. But if you happen to have the knowledge of where this merchant can be found and whether that merchant is open at a particular time under particular conditions, you can buy up as much of the stock of goods as you can and then distribute it in the auction house. This is a kind of arbitrage that is actually quite foundational to the economy of Final Fantasy XI. And the arbitrager, rather than being a person who is seen as being exploitative, is someone who is using well produced and valuable economic knowledge. So the arbitrager actually is seen as a virtuous person and who is able to command a larger price for their goods. I also talk. Oh, right. The economic life of Final Fantasy XI doesn't just exist in-game. I mentioned this website before. Final Fantasy AH is a fantastic website for people who want to sell things or want to find out how much things cost. So you can see here, I've taken screenshots of two sections of the website, the wanted section and the bazaar section, where people say how much they want to pay for something, or they say they want something in particular. You note there's the auction price here, and then how many are available on a particular server. This isn't working at the moment, but it does usually work. And there's also the sales rate, which is interesting. And it's worth noting that none of this comes to the company that produces the game. This has been outproduced by players for a sense of, you know, keeping track of their own economy. I'm not going to go into detail about balance and fairness, but I have tried to work out the argument of what fairness means. None of this should be that controversial for us. We all know that participation in the world requires consumption. We have certain consumption rituals we need to fulfill, whether that's Christmas dinner or children's birthdays or colleagues' going away gifts. Consumption requires money. We all know this. Money requires time and effort. Time is limited. Our obligations are not. So, in game, price rises mean more saving, farming, and the things you don't like to do, and less time for the things you do like to do. Again, this isn't that different than what we're used to. What is different is that the people in this virtual world have said, okay, we understand these conditions, so price rises mean that everything we want to do is no longer feasible. So we're going to collude together to ensure that price rises don't happen, so that we can maintain the balance of time, effort, and outcome in terms of money that we like to have. And what's amazing is you have the same price for commodities now in 2014 that you had in 2004. It's quite unthinkable in a growth-based economy. So customary prices, steady, reliable access to goods, and consumption according to effort and ability. But it's this one that's really important. The idea that participation is a measure of your social value and that everyone should have equal access to that measure of social value. It's not radical to us as sociologists to think about that. What is quite radical is that you have a group of people who are effectuating this in a virtual world where it's really not necessary. No one's going to die if they can't go raiding. This is actually a price output from Final Fantasy XI Auction House, and you can see there's been one dip in price, but all the sales have been the same. Nothing can make my argument better than that. What does balance mean? Balance is a key element of game design. It means economic interdependence. Players have a very strong sense that their access to goods is based on the labor of others. And if others aren't doing the work that's required to produce the resources or produce the commodities that are necessary, the whole economy falls apart. It's amazing how players start from a notion of individual responsibility and they come to a sense of shared outcomes. One of my respondents actually said, it's like Spider-Man. With great power comes great responsibility. And I thought, wow, you're a TV repairman, and you like Spider-Man, and we have so much in common. You can make these sort of profound statements about what the economy is like. Market predictability is seen as being a way to plan for the future. If you have rising prices, you're not having rising levels of welfare. You're having rising levels of welfare at the expense of other people having to pay for your rising level of welfare. Again, it's not strange to us as sociologists, but what's weird is to see an economy that's based on this. So making moral pricing decisions is about maintaining that balance. It's about ensuring that your achievement doesn't come at the cost of somebody else. And so this is about informal, individualized regulation. There's a notion that individuals can make powerful economic choices that have significant outcomes, which means methodological individualism, but with a very strong sense of responsibility. It's very strange. I don't have much time to talk about moralizing bad practices, but we can sum this up by saying you can do bad things only when they benefit others. So price gouging and manipulation, I talk about that in depth in the paper. And yes, Mad Martin Heidegger is very close to the actual game name of that person. There is a reference to Martin Heidegger, yes. The idea is that when markets go out of control, and respondents in this game world do see markets as being extremely fragile, because if individual actions produce significant outcomes, they can change the structure of how a market operates, or they can create market volatility, then markets are, by perforce, fragile. So the idea is when someone does something bad, like they have been gouging or they have been undercutting. Then someone else can engage in a series of practices that then restore correct and fair prices. I think it's amazing that when these activities happen, they involve sophisticated and quite complex relationships between commodities. So the goldsmithing example is not a matter of just increasing the price for gold ingots, it's a matter of manipulating gold ore and gold nuggets over the course of weeks and building up a huge hoard and then spitting it all out all over again. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you, Sandy. Here's a question. Dan.
I'm having a moment, so I'm really old now, such and stupid. So apologies in advance. I have no idea about Final Fantasy. I mean, I kind of have, like, from what you presented, it's an online gaming thing, right? That's about it. So if I'm on there, I mean, I'm not. Right? So if a person's on there and they're trying to buy something, what does that mean? Like, they're equipping their character on there with something. But is it tied into some other form of financial exchange as well? Do I have limitless amounts to spend while I'm on the game?
No, you have to make all of your money yourself. That's
how?
You make your money. You know, there are entire FAQs, hundreds of pages long, devoted to this question. There are a number of ways to make money instrumentally, that is to say, by completing quests and system-level achievements. So you can go and, you know, collect a certain number of tree sprouts for some non-player character, and then they give you small amounts of money, 1,000 gil, which is nothing, or 100 gil. Or you can harvest resources from the world itself. So you can mine, you can go fishing, you can harvest plants with a sickle. Then you have to sell those. So money is generated either quest through quests, and doing missions, or by killing monsters. But if you kill monsters, even if you're at the upper levels of the game and you're killing regular monsters at, you know, 60 or 70 an hour, however many, you're only getting between 1 and 100 gil per kill divided amongst 6 people, which is not very much. So there's a slow, steady trickle of money into the game, into the economy. But then that money goes out again. Because if you put money into an NPC, a non-player character merchant, that money disappears from the economy. Those are gil sinks, right? It's a very different way to wrap your head around where money comes from, to put it quite bluntly. Because it comes in through sort of routinized activities, and then it can drop out in large sums all at once or in small, steady trickles. What generally happens is that money tends to concentrate amongst those who already have it. Again, much like the real world.
Clear then, Philip. I have more of a comment which follows so perfectly on from Dan's Luddite position, which is similar to mine. Because the thing is, in another 15 years or so, you could skip out much of your explanatory part of the presentation, because the people sitting in front of you will have learned money that way anyway. And that was the step I wanted to go to in commenting, you know, because the purpose of why we're here is, you know, our everyday sense of how markets work. My son's 8, and we actually have to work to teach him about real-world money.
Mm.
He understands virtual money in every way possible. He understands it almost like a banker, because that's how his world is run. He knows that he can only buy new mods on the weekend, and he just found out what a mod was.
Explain.
A modification to the game.
Yeah.
And so that's just like buying the latest trend. And you have to have it, or else who are you in the world?
Well, you can't play with others
indeed,
who are playing
indeed.
the same
especially
maps.
The people you like.
Yeah.
So everything about his understanding of money has been built in the virtual world, but that's not what he's tested on at school.
Mm-hmm.
At school, he needs to recognize a £1 coin, a £2 coin. He almost never uses those, so we have to keep reminding him, like, you're in the store, take that out, use it. And it just seems weird, because as you just said, it doesn't work the same way as money works in the virtual world, and it doesn't come from the same place. So he's got a schism going on, and I just think that's really interesting, as we have a schism in the world between people who have grown up understanding virtual money better than real world money.
What's even more amazing about Final Fantasy XI is that I've only talked about one of its forms of money.
Yeah.
It has gil, which is the generic form of money. It has something like 14 other forms of what anthropologists would call special purpose money, and we can talk at length later about why special purpose money is a sort of ridiculous term for it, but they're caught in these, one would say quite literally, spheres of exchange. They aren't fungible, they aren't cross-convertible, they aren't even exchangeable. And it creates a very different sense of how an economy functions and how people's interdependence upon one another is created and sustained when you have something like 14 forms of money and they can only be used in certain activities with certain people and only with certain groups and certain commodities and certain access to services. It is a very different yet familiar mode of exchange, because if we think of anybody goes to Tesco, you have a Tesco club card, or maybe you have a Nectar points card. You can't go into, say, TK Maxx and pull out your Nectar card and say, okay, I'm going to buy things. You can't go into Waitrose with your Tesco. I'm going to Waitrose anyway. I can't afford even anything. Yeah. But you pull out your Tesco card in Waitrose, and what's that good for? So we think these worlds are so strange, but actually they have quite a bit in common with the kinds of systems that we deal with here,
yeah,
too.
That's fair enough, yeah.
Yeah, but I hear you. They lead to some different variations of money practices, too. Yeah, I think it's part of one and part of the other.
Thank you. I really enjoyed your paper, actually. I mean, there's so much in there, and so much you could say. And there's all sorts of authority struggles among your various members, whatever. But the thing that struck me is one of the tensions you mentioned in the paper is money that's been bought with real money from outside, and then Clear's comment, actually, I mean, my experience of these games like Minecraft or whatever is actually that they do cost real money because you have to buy the mods with real money. So there's always this kind of frisson between what's going on in the game with virtual money and then real money outside.
Yeah, we're talking about two very different kinds of games. So
there's more than one kind of Minecraft, though. There's a virtual and
This is a game where... Okay, so there's a new model has arisen called freemium or pay-to-play and different kinds of online games where there's more seamless blending of what you pay for and what you pay for with virtual money. Final Fantasy XI is a subscription-based game. You pay a fee every month to Square Enix and you have access to the game world and to all your possessions therein. Any other money you pay to anybody else is against the terms of service. So there is no secondary market of things you can buy through Square Enix or through authorized providers, whether that's mods or other kinds of things. When you are buying GIL through real money trading, you are buying it from probably sweatshopped workers in China, in Malaysia, in Latin America, who are living in these hideous dormitories, working 18 to 20 hour days, building up large amounts of gold. We can talk quite frankly and honestly about the whole world of real money trading as another form of global exploitation. And that would be a secondary topic and a very important one, but second to what's going on here. So I agree with you, yes, there's this kind of blending and participation and money practices, but that's in a different kind of game. In this kind of game where you have real money trading, it's strongly linked to moral transgression because it upsets the order, the meritocratic order of those who have spent all this time getting their money one monster at a time.
Minnie was next.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm kind of new to the discourse on price. So I'm trying to get my head around the difference between money and price. Is pricing one of the practices related to money, or is, you know, I'm kind of confused.
That wasn't a question I wanted to deal with in this paper. but you can consult Zimmel's philosophy of money for a notion, or Marx as well, about price being related to the velocity and volume of money and money in circulation. In this paper, actually, I would say what's most fascinating is that because of the steady trickle of money being generated through routine activities in, you know, really tiny sums, you have a virtual world where prices have remained flat, except possibly going down as some prestige items become more broadly spread throughout the economy. So the amount of money is constantly going up, and it's only small in its decrease in gil sinks or these places where money disappears from the economy. They don't have that big an influence. It's known as mudflation in those who study video games. Money's constantly being produced, new items are constantly being introduced, more powerful items supplanting the luxury items of the previous times. Again, this is not unusual. Fractional reserve banking is the same idea. So the idea is that even though you have a constantly increasing supply of money, the price is flat in Final Fantasy XI, which is again another queer, weird phenomenon. So I don't think I've answered your question, but I think I've explained why it's this world with respect to how we understand price and money is a bit different.
I'm also totally ignorant of these things. But it seems from what I understood that you want to play with certain people, and that's why you want to stay in the game, and that's why you continue to pay your subscription, and that's why you want certain sort of added on things. But how do you become friends with these people? How do you get to like these people?
You think that's actually
a relational game.
Social relations of gaming. Yeah.
This is a game though that is very different from other MMOs, and I could talk about that at length. I won't. But I think I'm very pleased that you've asked that question in this kind of environment, because in another kind of environment I would have to explain why social relations are important and why that's an important question to ask. It is a really important question because this is a virtual world where people have a high amount of interdependence. Until fairly recently, that is to say a patch in 2013 that produced a large amount of solo content, you could not play this game by yourself. You just couldn't. You can craft by yourself. Uh-huh. You can fish by yourself. But even to do those tasks and do them correctly, as I sort of hinted at in the paper, requires a tremendous amount of knowledge that others have built up for you. How do you know which bait is used to catch which fish? And out of the 260-odd places you can fish, how do you know that that place is the place that matches the bait and matches the fish? So there's a lot of, in one way, knowledge that's acquired from others is not directly making friends. But in another, you need to form parties. You need to form groups to go out and kill monsters and level up, and it's all very savage and murderous and so on. But you can't play the game unless you have those kinds of experiences. So yes, the formation of relationships is very much at the heart of everything that players do, whether it's sort of distant relationships through sharing of information online, or it's the quite brutal business of murdering goblins and sheep. Sheep are murdered as well.
So do you make friends with people who are like you? If you're an 8-year-old boy, do you find other 8-year-old boys?
No, generally that's mediated by link shells. So you have pickup parties, people that haven't talked. We can talk about this forever.
We might
need
to save some of this
for the later discussion.
For tea break.
But there are lots of ways, yes.
And I will save my question about series of play for then as well. Mm-hmm. And for now, just say thanks again, and we'll move on to
lots of
regrets.
Right.